50 Years in the Church of Rome by Charles Chinnicky, Chapter 54. In 1851, I was contacted by an Irishman, D'Arcy McGee, editor of the Freeman's Journal, official journal of the Bishop of New York. Mr. McGee was very interested not only in my colonization work, but the temperance movement as well. Through our correspondence, it became apparent we were of the same mind. Mr. McGee had determined to head a colonization project guiding his fellow countrymen to the fertile lands of the West, as the living conditions of the majority of Irish Roman Catholics were on a par with the people of Beauport prior to my arrival in that city. I attended a large assembly, principally composed of priests, who met at Buffalo in the spring of 1852. But what was his disappointment when he saw that the greatest part of those priests were sent by the bishops of the United States to oppose and defeat his plans? Though he spoke with burning eloquence, the majority coldly answered him, "We are also determined to take possession of the United States, but we must proceed with the utmost secrecy and wisdom." What does a skillful general do when he wants to conquer a country? Does he scatter his soldiers over the farmlands and spend their energy in plowing the fields? No, he keeps them close to his flanks and marching toward the strongholds, the rich and powerful cities. The farming countries then submit and become the price of this victory without moving a finger to subdue them. So it will be with us. Silently and patiently, we must mass our Roman Catholics in the great cities of the United States, remembering that the vote of a poor journeyman, though he be covered with rage, has as much weight in the scale of power as the millionaire Astor, and that if we have two votes against his one, he will become as powerless as an oyster. Let us then multiply our votes. Let us call our poor but faithful Irish Catholics from every corner of the world and gather them into the very hearts of the cities of Washington, New York, Boston, Chicago, Buffalo, Albany, Troy, Cincinnati, etc. Under the shadows of those great cities, the Americans consider themselves a giant, unconquerable race. They look upon the poor Irish Catholics with supreme contempt, as only fit to dig their canals, sweep their streets, and work in their kitchens. Let no one awake those sleeping lions today. Let us pray God that they continue to sleep a few years longer, waking only to find their votes outnumbered, as we will turn them forever out of every position of honor, power, and profit. When not a single judge or policeman will be elected if he be not a devoted Irish Catholic, what will those so-called giants think when not a single senator or member of Congress will be chosen unless he has submitted to our Holy Father, the Pope? We will not only elect the president, but fill and command the armies, man the navies, and hold the keys of the public treasury. It will then be time for our faithful Irish people to give up their grog shops in order to become the judges and governors of the land. Then, yes, then we will rule the United States and lay them at the feet of the Vicar of Jesus Christ, that he may put an end to their godless system of education and impious laws of liberty of their conscience, laws of liberty of conscience which are an insult to God and man. D'Arcy McGee was left almost alone when the votes were taken. From that, the Catholic priests gathered their Irish legions into the great cities of the United States of America. The day is very near when the Jesuits will rule every aspect of their country. They are already the masters of New York, Baltimore, Chicago, St. Paul, New Orleans, Mobile, Savannah, Cincinnati, Albany, Troy, Milwaukee, St. Louis, San Francisco, etc. Yes, San Francisco, the rich, the great queen of the Pacific, is in the hands of the Jesuits. From the very first days of the discovery of the gold mines of California, the Jesuits had the hopes of becoming masters of those inexhaustible treasures, and they secretly laid their plans with the most profound ability and success. The Jesuits saw at a glance that if they could persuade the Irish Catholics to settle and remain there, they would soon be the masters and rulers of the Golden City, whose future is so bright and great. The consequence is that while you find only a few Americans, Germans, Scotch, and English millionaires in San Francisco, you find more than 50 Catholic Irish millionaires in that city. Its rich Bank of Nevada, Nevada Bank, is in their hands, and so are all the street railways. The principal offices of the city are filled with Irish Roman Catholics. Almost all the police are composed of the same class, as well as the volunteer military associations. Their compact unity in the hands of the Jesuits, with their enormous wealth, make them almost supreme masters of the mines of California and Nevada. When one knows the absolute abject submission of the Irish Roman Catholics, rich or poor, to their priests, how the mind of the soul, the will, the conscience, are firmly and irrevocably tied to the feet of their priests, he can easily understand that the Jesuits of the United States form one of the richest and most powerful corporations the world ever saw. It is well known that those 50 Catholic millionaires, with their myriads of employees, are, through their wives and by themselves, continually at the feet of their Jesuit confessors. Where the Jesuits rule, there is little hope for a true Protestant to ever have a lucrative office in the United States today. It is to San Francisco that you must go to have an idea of the number of secret and powerful organizations with which the Church of Rome prepares for the impending conflict, through which she hopes to destroy the schools and every vestige of human rights and liberties in the United States. In order to more easily drill the Roman Catholics and prepare them for this struggle, the Jesuits have organized them into a great number of secret societies, the principal of which are Ancient Order of Hibernian, Irish American Society, Knights of St. Patrick, St. Patrick Cadets, St. Patrick Mutual Alliance, Apostles of Liberty, Benevolent Sons of the Emerald Isle, Knights of Peter, Knights of the Red Branch, Knights of the Columbskill, the Secret Heart, etc., etc. Almost all these secret associations are military ones. They have their headquarters at San Francisco, but their rank and file are scattered all over the United States. They number 700,000 soldiers who, under the name of U.S. Volunteer Militia, are officered by some of the most skillful generals and officers of this republic. Another fact to which the American Protestants do not sufficiently pay attention is that the Jesuits have been shrewd enough to to have a vast majority of Roman Catholic generals and officers to command the army and man the navy of the United States. Long before I was ordained a priest, I knew that my church was the most implacable enemy of this republic. My professors of philosophy, history, and theology had been unanimous in telling me that the principles and laws of the Church of Rome were absolutely antagonistic to the laws and principles which are the foundation stones of the Constitution of the United States. First, the most sacred principle of the United States Constitution is the equality of every citizen before the law. But the fundamental principle of the Church of Rome is the denial of that equality. Second, liberty of conscience is proclaimed by the United States a most sacred principle which every citizen must uphold, even at the price of his blood. But liberty of conscience is declared by all the popes and councils of Rome a most godless, unholy, and diabolical thing, which every good Catholic must abhor and destroy at any cost. Third, the American Constitution assures the absolute independence of the civil from the ecclesiastical or church power, but the Church of Rome declares through all her pontiffs and councils that such independence is an impiety and revolt against God. Fourth, the American Constitution leaves every man free to serve God according to the dictates of his conscience, but the Church of Rome declares that no man has ever had such a right, and that the Pope alone can know and say what man must believe and do. Fifth, the Constitution of the United States denies the right in any body to punish any other for differing from him in religion. But the Church of Rome says that she has the right to punish with the confiscation of their goods or the penalty of death those who differ in faith from the Pope. Sixth, the United States have established schools all over their immense territories where they invite the people to send their children, that they may cultivate their intelligence and become good and useful citizens. But the Church of Rome has publicly cursed all those schools and forbidden their children to attend them, under pain of excommunication in this world and damnation in the next. Seventh, the Constitution of the United States is based on the principle that the people are the primary source of all civil power. But hundreds of times the Church of Rome has proclaimed that this principle is impious and heretical. She says that all government must rest upon the foundation of the Catholic faith, with the Pope alone as the legitimate and infallible source and interpreter of the law. I could cite many other facts proving the Church of Rome to be an irreconcilable enemy of the United States, but it would be too long. Rome is a viper. Sooner or later, that viper will bite and kill this republic. This was foretold by Lafayette and is now promulgated by the greatest thinkers of our time. The great inventor of electric telegraphy, Samuel Morse, found it out when in Rome and published it in 1834 in his remarkable work, Conspiracies Against the Liberties of the United States. The learned Dr. S. Irenaeus Prime, in his life of Professor Morse, says, when Mr. Morse was in Italy, he became acquainted with several ecclesiastics of the Church of Rome, and he was led to believe, from what he learned from them, that a political conspiracy under the cloak of a religious mission was formed against the United States. When he came to Paris and enjoyed the confidence and friendship of Lafayette, he stated his convictions to the general, who fully concurred with him in the reality of such a conspiracy. That great statesman and patriot, Richard W. Thompson, Secretary of the Navy, in his admirable work, The Papacy and the Civil Power, says, "Nothing is plainer than that if the principles of the Church of Rome prevail here, our Constitution would necessarily fall. The two cannot exist together. They are an open and direct antagonism with the fundamental theory of our government and of all popular government everywhere." The eloquent Spanish orator, Kessler, speaking of his own Church of Rome, said in 1869, "There is not a single progressive principle that has not been cursed by the Catholic Church. This is true of England and Germany, as well as all Catholic countries. The Church cursed the French Revolution, the Belgian Constitution, and the Italian independence. Not a constitution has been born, not a step of progress made, not a solitary reform effected, which has not been under terrific anathemas of the Church." Why ask the testimony of Protestants or liberals to warn the American people against the conspiracy when we have the public testimony of all the bishops and priests to prove it? Read for yourselves the position taken by the Church of Rome today. I give you the following unimpeachable documents. Quote, "The Church is of necessity intolerant. Heresy she endures when and where she must, but she hates it and directs all her energies to destroy it. If Catholics ever gain a sufficient numerical majority in this country, religious freedom is at an end. So our enemies say, so we believe." And that's from the Shepherd of the Valley, Official Journal of the Bishop of St. Louis, November 23, 1851. "No man has a right to choose his religion," from the New York Freeman Official Journal of Bishop Hughes, January 26, 1852. "The Church does not and cannot accept or in any degree favor liberty in the Protestant sense of liberty." Catholic World, April 1870. "The Catholic Church is the medium and channel through which the will of God is expressed. While the state has rights, she has them only in virtue and by permission of the superior authority, and that authority can be expressed only through the Church." From the Catholic World, July 1870. "Protestantism has not and never can have any right where Catholicity has triumphed." Catholic Review, June 1875. "Religious liberty is merely endured until the opposite can be carried into effect without peril to the Catholic Church." That's from the Right Reverend O'Connor, Bishop of Pittsburgh. "There is ere long to be a state religion in this country, and that state religion is to be the Roman Catholic. First, the Roman Catholic is to weld his vote for the purpose of securing Catholic ascendancy in this country. Second, all legislation must be governed by the will of God unerringly indicated by the Pope. Third, education must be controlled by the Catholic authorities, and under education the opinions of the individual and the utterances of the press are included, and many opinions are to be forbidden by the secular arm, under the authority of the Church, even to war and bloodshed." That's from a priest, Hecker, Catholic World, July 1870. Continue to quote, "It was proposed that all religious persuasions should be free and their worship publicly exercised. But we have rejected this article as contrary to the canons and councils of the First Catholic Church," Pope Pius VII, 1808. One of the first and most solemn acts of the present Pope Leo XIII, was to order that the theology of St. Thomas Aquinas be taught in all colleges, seminaries, and universities of the Church of Rome as the most accurate teaching of the doctrines of his church. On the 30th December 1880, I forced the Right Reverend Foley, Bishop of Chicago, to translate from Latin into English before the court of Kankakee, and to swear that the following law was among those promulgated by St. Thomas as one of the present and unchangeable laws of the Church of Rome. Quoting, "Though heretics must not be tolerated because they deserve it, we must bear with them till by a second admonition they may be brought back to the faith of the Church. But those who, after a second admonition, remain obstinate in their errors must not only be excommunicated, but they must be delivered to the secular power to be exterminated." St. Thomas Aquinas, Summa Theologica, Volume 4, page 90. After the bishop had sworn that this was the true doctrine of the Church of Rome expressed by St. Thomas, and taught in all the colleges, seminaries, and universities of the Church of Rome, I forced him to declare under oath that he and every priest of Rome, once a year, under pain of eternal damnation, is obliged to say in the presence of God in his breviarium, that's his official prayer book, that that doctrine was so good and holy that every word of it has been inspired by the Holy Ghost to St. Thomas. The same Bishop Foley was again forced by me before the same court of Kankakee to translate from Latin into English the following decree of the Council of Lateran, and to acknowledge under oath that it was as much the law of the Church of Rome today as on the day it was passed in the year 1215. And quoting from that 1215 decree, "We excommunicate and anathematize every heresy that exalts itself against the holy Orthodox and Catholic faith, condemning all heretics by whatever name they may be known, for though their faces differ, they are all tied together by their tails. Such as are condemned are to be delivered over to the existing secular powers to receive due punishment. If laymen, their goods must be confiscated. If priests, they shall be degraded from their respective orders and their property applied to the church in which they officiated. Secular powers of all ranks and degrees are to be warned, induced, and if necessary, compelled by ecclesiastical censure to swear that they will exert themselves to the utmost in the defense of the faith and extirpate all heretics denounced by the church who shall be found in their territories. And whenever any person shall assume government, whether it be spiritual or temporal, he shall be bound to abide by this decree. If any temporal lord, after having been admonished and required by the church, shall neglect to clear his territory of heretical depravity, the metropolitan and bishop of the province shall unite in excommunicating him. Should he remain contumacious a whole year, the fact shall be signified to the supreme pontiff, who will declare his vassals released from their allegiance from that time, and will bestow his territory on Catholics to be occupied by them, on condition of exterminating the heretics and preserving the said territory in the faith. Catholics who shall assume the cross for the extermination of heretics shall enjoy the same indulgence and be protected by the same privileges as are granted to those who go to the help of the Holy Land. We decree further that all those who have dealings with heretics, and especially such as receive, defend, and encourage them, shall be excommunicated. He shall not be eligible to any public office. He shall not be admitted as a witness. He shall neither have the power to bequeath his property by will, nor succeed to an inheritance. He shall not bring any action against any person, but anyone can bring action against him. Should he be a judge, his decision shall have no force, nor shall any cause be brought before him. Should he be an advocate, he shall not be allowed to plead. Should he be a lawyer, no instruments made by him shall be held valid, but shall be condemned with their authors. Cardinal Manning, speaking in the name of the Pope, said, I acknowledge no civil power. I am the subject of no prince, and I claim more than this. I claim to be the supreme judge and director of the conscience of men, of the peasants that till the fields, and of the prince that sits upon the throne, of the household that lives in the shade of privacy, and the legislator that makes laws for kingdoms. I am sole, last, supreme judge of all that is right and wrong. Moreover, we declare, affirm, define, and pronounce it to be necessary to salvation, to every human creature, to be subject to the Roman Pontiff. And that's from the tablet, October 9, 1864. Undoubtedly, it is the intention of the Pope to possess this country. In this intention, he is aided by the Jesuits and all the Catholic prelates and priests. That was written in the Brownson Review, May 1864. No good government can exist without religion, and there can be no religion without an inquisition, which is wisely designed for the promotion and protection of the true faith. That was written in the Boston Pilot, official journal of the bishop. Quoting again, the power of the church exercised over sovereigns in the Middle Ages was not a usurpation, was not derived from the concessions of princes or the consent of the people, but was and is held by divine right. And whoso resists it rebels against the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Brownson's Review, June 1851. The Council of Constance, held in 1414, declared that any person who has promised security to heretics shall not be obliged to keep his promise by whatever he may be engaged. Under this principle, John Huss was publicly burned the 6th of July, 1415, in the city of Constance, though he had a safe passport from the emperor. Quoting again, Negroes have no rights which the white man is bound to respect. Roman Catholic Chief Justice Taney, in his Dred Scott decision. If the liberties of the American people are ever destroyed, they will fall by the hands of the Catholic clergy. That's from Lafayette. See, sir, it's another quote, from this chamber I govern not only to Paris, but to China, not only to China, but to all the world, without anyone knowing how I do it. And that was from Tamburini, who was at that time general of the Jesuits. Another quote, a man who has been excommunicated by the Pope may be killed anywhere. That's from Lacroix, Theologica Moralis, 1757. If then you receive a command from one who holds the place of God, you should observe it as if it came from God Himself. It may be added that there is more certainty of doing the will of God by obedience to our superiors than by obedience to Jesus Christ, should He appear in person and give His command. That's from so-called Saint Liguori in the Nun Sanctified. That's the Nun, N-U-N, Sanctified. The Jesuits are a military organization, not a religious order. Their chief is a general of an army, not the mere father abbot of a monastery. And the aim of this organization is power. Power in its most despotic exercise. Absolute power. Universal power. Power to control the world by the volition of a single man. Jesuitism is the most absolute of despotisms, and at the same time the greatest and most enormous of abuses. And that's a memorial of the captivity of Napoleon at St. Helena by General Montholon. In the elocution of September 1851, Pope Pius IX said that he had taken the principles for bases that the Catholic religion, with all its votes, ought to be exclusively dominant in such sort that every other worship shall be banished and interdicted. You ask if the Pope were lord over this land, and you were in a minority, what he would do to you? That, we say, would entirely depend on circumstances. If it would benefit the cause of Catholicism, he would tolerate you. If expedient, he would imprison, banish you. Probably he might even hang you. But be assured of one thing. He would never tolerate you for the sake of your glorious principles of civil and religious liberty. That's from the Rambler, one of the most prominent Catholic papers of England, September 1851. Lord Acton, one of the Roman Catholic peers of England, reproaching her bloody and anti-social laws to his own church, wrote, Pope Gregory VII decided it was no murder to kill excommunicated persons. This rule was incorporated in the canon law. During the revision of the code, which took place in the 16th century, and which produced a whole volume of corrections, the passage was allowed to stand. It appears in every reprint of the Corpus Juris. It has been for 700 years, and continues to be, part of the ecclesiastical law. Far from being a dead letter, it obtained a new application in the days of the Inquisition, and one of the later popes has declared that the murder of a Protestant is so good a deed that it atones, and more than atones, for the murder of a Catholic. In the last Council of the Vatican, has the Church of Rome expressed any regret for having promulgated and executed such bloody laws? No. On the contrary, she has anathematized all those who think or say that she was wrong when she deluged the world with the blood of the millions she ordered to be slaughtered. To quench her thirst for blood, she positively said that she had the right to punish those heretics by tortures and death. Those bloody and antisocial laws were written on the banners of the Roman Catholics when slaughtering 100,000 Waldensians in the mountains of Piedmont, and more than 50,000 defenseless men, women, and children in the city of Béziers. It is under the inspiration of these diabolical laws of Rome that 75,000 Protestants were massacred the night and following week of St. Bartholomew. It was to obey those bloody laws that Louis XIV revoked the Edict of Nantes, caused the death of 500,000 of men, women, and children who perished in all the highways of France, and caused twice that number to die in the land of exile, where they had found a refuge. Those antisocial laws today are written on her banners with the blood of 10 millions of martyrs. It is under those bloody banners that 6,000 Roman Catholic priests, Jesuits, and bishops in the United States are marching to the conquest of this republic, backed by their 7 millions of blind and obedient slaves. Those laws, which are still the ruling laws of Rome, were the main cause of the last rebellion of the southern states. Yes, without Romanism, the last awful civil war would have been impossible. Jeff Davis would never have dared to attack the North had he not had assurance from the Pope that the Jesuits, the bishops, the priests, and the whole people of the Church of Rome, under the name and mask of democracy, would help him. These diabolical and antisocial laws of Rome caused a Roman Catholic, Beauregard, to be the man chosen to fire the first gun at Fort Sumter against the Flag of Liberty on the 12th of April 1861. Those anti-Christian and anti-social laws caused the Pope of Rome to be the only crown prince in the whole world, so depraved as to publicly shake hands with Jeff Davis and proclaim him president of a legitimate government. These are the laws which led the assassination of Abraham Lincoln to the house of a rabid Roman Catholic woman, Mary Surratt, which was not only the rendezvous of the priests of Washington, but the very dwelling house of some of them. Those bloody and infernal laws of Rome nerved the arm of the Roman Catholic Booth when he slaughtered one of the noblest men God has ever given to the world. Those bloody and antisocial laws of Rome, after having covered Europe with ruins, tears, and blood for 10 centuries, have crossed the oceans to continue their work of slavery and desolation, blood and tears, ignorance and demoralization on this continent. Under the mask and name of democracy, they have raised the standard of rebellion of the South against the North, and caused more than 500,000 of the most heroic sons of America to fall on the fields of carnage. In a very near future, if God does not miraculously prevent it, those laws of dark deeds and blood will cause the prosperity, the rights, the education, and the liberties of this too confident nation to be buried under a mountain of smoking and bloody ruins. On the top of that mountain, Rome will raise her throne and plant her victorious banners. Then she will sing her Te Deums and shout her joys of joy, as she did when she heard the lamentations and cries of desolation of the millions of martyrs in the capitals and great cities of Europe.